to order, and it is Tuesday, April 24th. We have a first bill up. We have public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2555. Jim, you want to...
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2555, which is known as one of the search and rescue bills, has a dash 2 amendment, which should be in your packet. It requires the Office of Emergency Management to coordinate multi-county search and rescue activities. The amendment replaces the bill when search and rescue resources are deployed and the search area involves more than one jurisdiction, then one sheriff or their authorized designee shall assume command, or the jurisdiction shall form a unifying command as outlined by the National Incident Management System. If one particular sheriff or regional search and rescue council does not take command of the incident, then by default, the sheriff's office that received the call first will be in charge of the operation. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, I'll call up Seth, you want to come up first? Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Seth Hatmaker, Chief of Staff Representative John Lynn. And I am here basically just to, so the committee knows that Representative Lim is aware of the amending of the bill. He was very supportive. Joe O'Leary with the governor's office and Administrator Jim Keller were both gave us plenty, ample time, gave us courtesy, and everybody, I think, is pleased with it. So,
anybody have questions for
Seth? I don't have any questions, Madam Chair, but thank you for coming and letting us have that comfort in that, because we appreciated Representative Lim when he was here and testified on the bill, and I'm glad to know that he's satisfied with it.
Yes, thank you, members.
Yeah, thanks very much, Seth.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Joe O'Leary. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Is he going to tell us how satisfied the governor is with the bill?
I hope so. Hope so.
Chair Boone, members of the Joint Committee, good afternoon. Joe O'Leary for the record. I'm Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. I am prepared to testify on House Bill 2555 and the amendment that I spoke with Representative Lim about. If it pleases the Joint Committee and the co-chairs, I'm also prepared to testify as to the contents of Senate Bill 1002 and Senate Bill 1003, which contain, as amended, will contain the legislative recommendations of the Governor's Search and Rescue Task Force.
Okay, and I'm going to also open a hearing, public hearing, and possible work session on Senate Bill 1002, and I will open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 1003. So we now have all three, and well, we have Joe up here.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Co-Chair Bruin, I served as the chair of the Governor's Search and Rescue Task Force. The task force was formed by Governor Kulongoski on January 19th, and he asked the task force to look at our Oregon's statutes, rules, policies, and best practices related to search and rescue and determine what changes, if any, were appropriate in order to ensure proper communication and coordination between state, local, and federal entities when it came to search and rescue efforts. I want to acknowledge some of the members of the task force. Your co-chairs, Representative Boone and Senator Verger, served as ex officio members of the task force. Your member, Senator Johnson, served as a member of the task force. And Representative Ron Maurer also served as a member to the task force. Present in the gallery today are task force members Jeff Jacqua of the U.S. Forest Service. Jeff is the SAR coordinator for the Zigzag Ranger Station in the Mount Hood area. George Kleinbaum, who is the SAR coordinator for the Office of Emergency Management, and Detective Mike Weinstein, who is a detective with Portland Police and leads their missing persons unit. The members of this task force, I can't say enough, were absolutely fantastic. We had a great group of people who brought together a diverse amount of experience and skill and knowledge, and in a very short period of time, we discussed, debated, and analyzed a broad range of issues relating to search and rescue. And the members who served had a deep commitment to this issue and to their mission. They demonstrated professionalism and collegiality. I have copies of the task force report that I'd like to circulate. Thank you. For you. And I also have a one-page copy that is a summary of the major concepts that are in House Bill 2555, Senate Bill 1002, and Senate Bill 1003.
Excuse me just a minute. We have Representative Ron Maurer. Would you like to come up to the dais with us? Oh, there or here? Yes. Welcome. And Representative Maurer, as Mr. O'Leary said, served on the task force, too. So we'll just have everybody. Thank you for the report very much. This is actually a lot easier to read than online, although I've seen it and marked it up on there, too. Are there any questions so far for Joe?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Joe, the question I think is for you, but certainly, Ron, if you want to jump in, do so. The problems with these and these kinds of things is the incident command system. In other words, who's in charge? And in looking at the bill, it seems to be that in the multi-county, the sheriff, there is a designated person. Or, if that person doesn't do it, the person that receives the initial call. To me, that's vague. Please make that more precise for me, because that sounds like, well, maybe Coos County, but then, you know, Douglas County received the call, so the Douglas County Sheriff is going to do it. So clarify that for me.
Co-Chair Boone and Co-Chair Verger, I think, and I will confess, having just received the amendment about an hour ago, and I've had a chance to look at it, and I will be relieved if you tell me that you don't intend to move it today so that we will have at least a night to look at it carefully and make sure it achieves the policy goals that you want, as well as the ones that the task force intended. But what we intended, and I say we, what the task force intended with that particular recommendation was to clarify the part of the statute that currently does not address multi-county searches. It simply says that the sheriff in the affected county is in charge of search and rescue for that county. So what we sought to do in the amendment to 1002, which I think is in Section 1 of the amendment, is to clarify that if you have a multi-county search operation, then the person in charge is one of the affected sheriffs or a unified command, which is an incident management term of art, and that is to say representatives of each sheriff's office who act as the incident commander. And then it goes on to say, as a default, if none of those sheriff's offices step up and either one takes charge or a unified command is not created, then the default is that the first sheriff to have taken the call is the one who is in charge. And if the language does not clearly state that, I absolutely agree with you that we have to make it clear.
It's a follow-up. It's a Section 1, 5, subsection 5, and it's A. I would just like to say that, just kind of anecdotally, that if there is a call to Charleston, or if there's an incident in Charleston, and the call is made maybe not to Charleston, but maybe to Douglas County, thinking that it was not in that particular county. I just want to be really clear that when the call it comes in, that we know who's in charge. That's all. Any comments, Ron?
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Boone and members of the committee. I want to back up before I answer your question and say that the Search and Rescue Task Force obviously took its duties very seriously, and that we really did focus on the larger picture about search and rescue in the state of Oregon without focusing on specifically any one search and rescue, which was clear by the result. But it also was clear in that first night, the very first meeting, that there was a hole in command and control from a statutory standpoint. And that Joe and I had a conversation after that first meeting. I said, you know, that there's clearly a hole here in these multi-county jurisdictional search and rescue situations. And so we set out early on to come up with language, and the intent was never to take anything away from the sheriffs. And that was a goal stated by the governor and accepted by everybody on the committee, that was not an attempt to take that power away, but it was a matter of clarification. And I believe that when the original language was crafted, that the notion of a multi-jurisdictional search of this nature was not contemplated. And so it's really an advent of technology and speed of transportation and other issues that this came to light, and that clearly that this was a weakness of the statutory language. And the language was crafted by the Sheriff's Association because we asked them to come up with a language that met certain parameters of, you know, pin the rose, tell us who's going to be in charge, but we don't want to tell you how to do that. And so the language really came from the Sheriff's Association, and I believe, having initially read it, and I'm not a lawyer, but that it does pin the rose, because it's extremely important that you identify who's in charge and you identify it early on, because I think in one of the major searches that was an issue. That we were unable to identify, and no one really was statutorily identified as who was in charge. So, as a long-winded answer to the question, I think that the language is appropriate. It may appear to be somewhat nebulous, but in fact, it isn't. It's very straightforward, and the people that have to implement it produce the language, and so therefore, I'm comfortable with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm confused between the language that we have here in the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2555 and Senate Bill 1002. Are we picking one of these?
Co-Chair Boone and Representative Cowan, it may help if I walk you through exactly what's in each. The language of the two sections that you just pointed out, the dash 2 of 2555 and section 1 of the dash 1 of 1002 are exactly the same.
That's what it looks like.
They are. And what they do, they both, they're exactly the same. They're both addressing the exact same issue, multi-county searches. Co-Chair Verger asked me to work with Representative Lim on his bill, 2555, as his chief of staff testified earlier. And I expressed to Representative Lim that the task force had a slightly different solution for the multi-county search issue than he originally had in 2555. And he assented to us offering this amendment to make it consistent with what the task force's recommendations were. I also put it in the request for the amendment on 1002 just out of completeness, because I had all of the other recommendations of the search and rescue task force that did not have a fiscal impact in that bill. That kind of speaks to the big picture of the Dash 1 amendment to 1002 are the legislative recommendations out of the Search and Rescue Task Force that do not have a fiscal impact to the state. And the still to be released amendment to Senate Bill 1003, which we don't have back from Legislative Council yet, is the legislative recommendation out of the task force that does have a fiscal impact. 1003 will provide funding to the Office of Emergency Management to create 6 regional search and rescue coordinators throughout the state. The concepts in the dash 1 to 1002, back to the bill that doesn't have a fiscal impact, include the multi-county search, the requirement of the implementation of the National Incident Management System, the strengthening of search and rescue critiques, the missing person subpoena, the discretionary leave of absence for search and rescue volunteers from employment, and a couple of cleanup issues, deletion of obsolete references in the search and rescue chapter 401 of the code. I also note, after a brief review of 1002, the dash 1 to 1002, that there are two additional sections in it, section 6 and section 8. And those did not come out of the search and rescue task force, but what they are, one is section 6 is a conforming change, and section 8 is to my read of it is a cleanup of a section that exists currently in that statute. My understanding is that when Legislative Council opens up the books on one section and it sees some language that they no longer use, they implement their style manual, if you will, and make those corrections. So I think that those are non-substantive housekeeping measures.
Joe, did you put in a dollar amount in your amendment?
I did not, and Co-Chair Boone, that you're referencing the still to come,
right,
amendment to 1003. Yeah. My understanding of that request was that it would fund 6 additional staff members for the Office of Emergency Management to be placed regionally around the state to assist the sheriffs in and search and rescue councils in the coordination of efforts. And I would defer to George Kleinbaum, who can speak to you more about that one.
And we also have passed out to you today, because I think Kane's back east again, testimony on Senate Bill 1002 and 1003. And he mentions that in his, if you'll notice, he asks the committee careful consideration of requirements or tasks given to Oregon Emergency Management and the potential financial issues associated with these possible new duties. And goes on to say, this portion of proposed search and rescue amendments could be adapted potentially to House Bill 2923, which asks for regional emergency management coordinators. So that sounds like that's tied in there. Okay. Questions?
Are we going to try to work both House Bill 2555 and
we're actually we have 1002 we have again? Hearings open on 2555, 1002, and 1003 right now. And so yes,
I guess I'm just confused as to if the language is the same, why we're working two of them.
Madam Chair, just to validate Representative Cowan's confusion, I am thoroughly confused as well. If we have two bills that do ostensibly the same thing, why don't we just jettison one of them and focus on the bill at hand? I understand the nexus between 2555 and 1002. I don't understand the nexus with 003.
Thank you, Senator. I was actually following a suggestion. So, Joe, you've asked, though, to hold on until you can get the amendments settled in.
Co-Chair Boone, if I had my druthers, I'm not the chair of the committee, but I would love for you to hold. I know that since this is a joint committee, you do not have the same restrictions about getting bills out as single chamber committees, and I would, since we just got the one set of amendments and we still don't have the 1003 amendments, I would, and especially in light of Senator Verger's concern about the multi-county search language too. Love to have a couple of days to run this by the rest of the task force, sit down with legislative council, and make sure we've got it all right.
Maybe Mr. O'Leary could help us understand what's the connection with 003 with the other two bills.
Co-Chair Boone, Senator Johnson, the way that the concepts were crafted was that 1002 has the concepts that do not have a fiscal impact, and 1003 has the only concept that came out of the task force that does have a fiscal impact. That, I presume, will have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I didn't, my directions from the governor were to get as many of the concepts that did not cost money as possible into one vehicle so that they could, if the legislature deemed fit, become law without having to get caught up in financial discussions.
Madam Chair. So you might, once you have the amendments in your hand, you might be coming back to the committee and suggesting an amalgamation.
Co-Chair Boone, Senator Johnson, I don't necessarily think so. I think that 1003 is going to have a fiscal impact no matter what, and 1002 is not. So I think you keep them separate would be my preference.
That's my understanding, too.
I understand that there are amendments pending for 1003, and since I don't have any idea what those are, is it essentially a rewrite of this one? As I read the single page I have in front of me, it speaks to requiring tsunami emergency drills, which I frankly have a problem with. If you're going to tell me it's a whole new bill, I'll be happier to look forward to amendments.
Co-Chair Boone, Representative Cowan, I'm pleased to make you happy. It will be a whole new bill. That was just placeholder language that I requested to keep the relating clause and to hold that vehicle. I had to have bills filed before the task force was done with its report. I needed to meet certain deadlines.
Understood. Follow up one more thing, and I'll try to stop. As you go through the presentation of these, can you please reassure me that the sheriffs have been involved with the conversation since so much responsibility is rested upon them?
Co-Chair Boone, Representative Cowan, I can absolutely reassure you of that. Sheriff Tim Evinger from Klamath County was the representative of the Sheriff's Association. Sheriff Evinger is the chair of the Sheriff's Association Search and Rescue Committee, and Dave Burright, the executive director of the Sheriff's Association, is present here today and hopefully is shaking his head in agreement with what I'm saying. So that reassurance.
Madam Chair, then, given the current state of affairs, are you looking for a motion or something that would sort of move us on?
We have more testimony, and I don't intend to move the bill today.
Okay.
Oh, any other questions for our experts? And thank you. I want to thank the members of the task force. I see people around now. They're coming in. So next we'll call up Jeff Jaqua. I didn't know if it was Jaqua or Jaqua. Is it Jaqua? Jaqua. Wasn't even close. Welcome.
Thank you.
And all three hearings are open. So you may testify on them, and you can start with 2555 and then 1002 and 1003 if you want to go in order.
Thank you.
You can flip around, whatever you want to do.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I do want to make just a general statement in support of for the record, Jeff Jakeway. I'm the search and rescue coordinator for the Zigzag Ranger District on the Mountain National Forest, and also, as you've heard earlier, a member of the task force. I have near 20 years of experience in search and rescue in this state, so when I was invited to serve on the task force, I was honored. I do want to state that the search and rescue community in this state saw the task force as a great opportunity for a thorough and holistic study of all the SAR practices in the state, not just focusing on any particular situation or specific issue. The task force took that charge very seriously, I can tell you, and we believe as a task force that the recommendations before you will move search and rescue in this state in a positive forward in a positive and efficient way, and we can do our job a lot better. So with that, I ask for your consideration and for all these recommendations. And that's my statement, but I will entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions? He can answer anything you want to know about search and rescue.
Madam Chair, I just have
a
general statement more than anything. I'm glad you didn't, you know, look at isolated incidents because, I mean, the men and women out there that search for us when we lose ourselves are doing their best. And in no way, shape, or form do I want this to be any kind of exercise of blame, and I don't think it is. But I and I'm glad we're filling statutory holes and squaring away chain of command and making it, you know, a well-oiled machine. But in the end, Oregon, I said it last time, this is a big country, and you better be prepared, whether it's winter or summer. And people are, no matter what we do here, there's going to be folks out there making poor choices, and we're going to have to go look for them. And I don't know how to legislate that, Madam Chair, but I just wanted to thank all the work you all did, and once again, thank the men and women who go out there and look for people when we lose ourselves. So
that would be my, you're looking for my bill on requiring common sense and kindness.
There you go. We can amend the plain talk bill with common sense.
That's exactly right.
Amendment.
Yeah. Senator Martha, oh, you looked expectant. Well, thank you very much, and thanks for making the trip down here.
Hope you
can find your way back to. I'm kidding. Mike will help you. Senator Morris.
I will comment because I think there's one thing we should be mandating, and that is when people climb high mountains, there should be a requirement that they carry a locator. Now, whether or not they choose to, that's a different thing, but we should require that they have a locator and make that known to the best of our ability so they will do it. But, you know,
there was a bill.
Well, I hope so.
I voted for your way. Yeah.
Okay, good, because that's important.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I think the Senator wants to respond.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I just would like to put on the record that I subscribe to my good friend and colleague, Senator Morissette's philosophy up until my participation on the Search and Rescue Task Force, and my opinion has turned 180 degrees. Simply putting on a locator and climbing Mount Hood in sneakers and a windbreaker doesn't assure that you are going to be found. And we heard from the very professionals who go up and hunt for people who went up there without a degree of personal responsibility, without the requisite skills, and the false sense of security that wearing one of those devices provides for inadequate, underprepared, out-of-shape climbers is not worth the offset of us all feeling good as though we've done something to protect people and protect searchers and rescuers. So what seems to be common sense, I think, is suffused with a lot more issues that are raised by the professional mountaineering community. And the number of searchers, the number of people that are lost on Mount Hood pales in comparison to the number that wander off hunting for mushrooms or something and just disappear in the woods. So I think that the simplistic answer is not always the best answer.
I think we just heard her floor speech.
It doesn't hurt.
Okay, next is Rocky Henderson, and he signed up for both 1002 and 1003. So have at her. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Rocky Henderson. I'm with Portland Mountain Rescue. Co-Chair Boone, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. I'm here today just in support of the task force work. I've been involved in search and rescue for more than 20 years, mostly on Mount Hood and in the state of Oregon. I'm one of those guys that goes out and searches on Mount Hood, and I've been involved in mountain locator searches and bad accidents, and I'm just here to say, you know, the events that have taken place over the last year in Oregon has kind of been a force that has brought us here today, and there have been things that needed to be fixed, needed to be improved in search and rescue, and I think the process, as I've seen it develop with the task force and with legislative forces trying to kind of fix things and make things better, I think we are on that path. And I'm just here today to say that I support what the task force has been doing. I am one of those that have disagreed with the Beacon Bill, and I have fought it diligently, and I believe that we have stopped it. That's my opinion, and that's what I'm here to say. But I'm here to support the bills that are before you today in their concepts. I think there's some work to be done in actual wording, and you'll work on that. But overall, I just want to say that, you know, that the search and rescue community, as volunteers of who I'm speaking for today, are very much behind all of the work that the task force is doing, and that you are now faced with kind of trying to put into law. So with that, I would answer any questions, but thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Is Senator Morissette?
Thank you. Well, this will be a teachable moment. Why are you opposed to the beacon? Are you beacon? Is that the locator? What's the beacon?
The beacon is, I'm speaking specifically about beacons in general. The mountain locator unit is a very specific device that was developed just for Mount Hood.
Uh-huh.
There's new technology that we're working on and developing. I think Senator Johnson said it very clearly, that our strongest argument is kind of what happens in a climber's mind and the decision process that is developed when there is that sort of perceived safety net of a beacon. And when they have a beacon, what it does to their decision process, we feel, leads them down a dangerous path. And that we would rather educate climbers to be more self-reliant and make good choices and not rely on us or the state to kind of come and save them if they do make a bad choice. Not that we're not going to make every effort to save them if they do. We will. But we just feel that making a law that requires that is kind of a path that has unintended consequences. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I voted for the bill, too. And I, for the life of me, I think the right choice is not to climb the darn thing in the first place.
There you go.
So, for the life of me, what encourages people to climb up there? But in more general statement than anything, you're probably right, the psychology of a climber up there. But I think everybody who climbs that mountain has a false sense of security in their ability to begin with. Be quite frank, it's way bigger than us. And I'm not saying we outlaw climbing the mountain, but I think we should, in general, I mean, I'm a backpacker. I've been out in the bush for several days. Could have easily been lost, but I didn't have a compass, topographical map, know where I was going, and had my pals with me, too, so we could, you know, if we did have a question, we could work it out. But if I ever go out again like that, and I never took a beacon with me, I'm taking one with me. And we always stop at the ranger station, tell them where we're going, here's our plan, here's our route, and we leave it with our families, really do all the thoughtful preparation. You can still get lost. But I'm taking one with me. I don't care if it's in the middle of summer.
I would strongly encourage that you right. continue in that attitude, and that's exactly what we want. We are not against beacons.
Right.
We are totally in favor of the use of beacons and any technology that makes you safer in the mountains. And that's not our point. Our
right.
point is just that we feel that making laws takes you down a path where the decision process gets messed up.
I can appreciate that. Thank you.
I would bring a lucky lab with you, too.
Yeah.
Warm dog is always good to have.
A big warm dog.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate having you here.
One other question. Could you answer another question?
Senator Morissette.
As a former commercial fisherman without a Loran locator, I was out about 12 miles, and the Coast Guard wanted to know where I was. And I said, well, gee, I can see the lighthouse. I'm straight out. Well, it took 4 hours, and it took another boat coming by before they radioed where I was. And if it had been foggy, I'd still be there. So I guess I was kind of relating that to the beacon. I mean, I should have had one. I didn't. And I usually didn't go out that far. But a locator for being lost in the ocean is a lifesaver.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But they're not required for most boaters.
No, no, there's not.
There's no law that says you have to have one. It's just a good idea. And I think that's the point.
Yeah, well, I guess the thing about the search and rescue is it costs thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars and risk of lives of the people who go. Lost in the ocean, you know, the cost of the search is not nearly as much. And the money that we put into and the risk of lives finding those climbers, we found one body and never did find the other two. It just seems like if people are... I would put a bond. I would require people to pay a bond if they're going to climb the mountain. You know, a $100,000 bond. Something to get them to pay attention, but I don't know if that...
No, I appreciate your sentiments very, very clearly. Search and rescue is not an expense to the taxpayers in a very, very small way. Most all of the search and rescue done in this state is done by volunteers. We buy our own gas, we buy our own equipment, and we do it because we love the mountain and we want to continue to keep it an open and free space to enjoy mountain climbing.
But you put your life at risk doing it.
I do that, but it's my choice.
Okay.
No one's forcing me to, and I do it because I feel it's my responsibility to my community.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron. Okay, now I'll bring up on Senate Bill or House Bill. Actually, it is Senate Bill 1002. Michael Weinstein, also from the task force. Welcome, Michael.
Co-Chair Boone, Co-Chair Verger, members of the Joint Committee, appreciate the opportunity to address you today. And for the record, my name is Michael Weinstein. I am a detective with the Portland Police Bureau, and I happen to be the missing persons detective from the homicide assault detail. I've been a sworn member of law enforcement for almost 17 years and have been the missing persons detective for about 4 years now. During that time, I've been responsible for investigating and or managing over 1,700 missing persons cases, many of which have been actually involved search and rescue function beyond just looking for people. I'm here as a member of the Search and Rescue Task Force, of course, and would like to show support for the measures in front of you, the issues in front of you today. As a member of the task force, I too would echo that we worked extremely hard and we're open to new ideas and to cooperation to accomplish our goals to address the issues of communication and the other issues we were charged with, which include interagency communication, cooperation, increasing the efficiency and professionalism of search and rescue in the state of Oregon. And we take that very seriously. And I can speak for the people I work with on a daily basis that we take that issue seriously every day. I'm going to specifically direct my comments mostly to Senate Bill 1002, specifically Section 4, which addresses the concept of the missing person's civil investigatory subpoena in seeking information or documents which would directly assist in locating or determining the whereabouts of missing persons in this state. Excuse me, I apologize because I'm losing my voice. The issues that are tantamount here are these. We need a tool in place that goes beyond what statutorily is provided for right now, which includes criminal investigation. We already have that tool available to us. Creating an investigative subpoena that would be civil in nature would allow us to address issues where there's no probable cause for a crime, which is very common in missing persons investigations. It would allow us to go to private sector businesses as well, where there is no statutory authority to mandate the production of records, to directly save lives, is my belief. And we've operated in the past on the spirit of cooperation, if you will, or voluntariness. And we need something in the law to provide us that statutory authority to request these records that would mandate their production. It would allow us specifically to address issues that are not already covered. I would like to point out just a few brief bullets when you're reading through the language. Issues that I think need further examination, if you will, because some of them are slightly nebulous or unclear. And I admit I've only had less than an hour or two to look at this myself since this came out today. But on page, this is Senate Bill 1002, Section 4, Subsection 3, is on line 23. One of the issues I think we'll need to look at, it states that an individual in possession of subpoenaed information, up to where it says the individual believes in good faith that a missing individual is subject to an emergency and other stipulations. I think we need to address that so that the individual we're going to for the information, the holder of those documents, their belief system shouldn't come into play. This should be based on probable cause, whether it's more likely than or not to a legal standard, and it would be submitted through a city attorney, district attorney, circuit court judge, or appropriate magistrate to secure this information through the power of subpoena. The Section 4 on the same page references if information is disclosed prior to the service, the actual service of a subpoena, that a subpoena must be served as soon as practicable. I'd just like to make sure that we address the idea of exigency. And the task force discussed this at length, exigency being the idea that if we have the statutory authority as law enforcement or as a peace officer to make this request, given the appropriate time available where someone's life wouldn't be further endangered or at risk of greater loss by waiting too long a time period, after hours, a weekend, what have you. The power of exigency would allow us to go to the same holder of that information and say, we have the statutory authority in these circumstances, but we don't have the time and someone's life may be at risk. So we'd like you to recognize that statutory authority, provide it to us beforehand, and if is necessary, we will provide the subpoena ex post facto or after the fact to satisfy that request.
You know, it seems like, and I have to comment on this, it just reminds me of in emergency, for example, a flood, and you're losing a building or something, you can do something even though you might need a permit for it from Division of State Lands and then ask them and say, we'll do the permit after the fact. But they can do actually save the property during the emergency if that's necessary. And this kind of reminds me of the same kind of thing. It's pretty common sense.
Kutcher Boone, I would agree in the sense that we all want to act prudently and minimize the loss. In this case, we're talking loss of life.
Yeah.
And I would agree that is a good analogy. Oftentimes, when I can speak from personal experience, from the many times I've gone to businesses or individuals requesting information where it is time critical, the time-critical nature of it comes into play when it's a very fresh investigation, as opposed to maybe one that's been ongoing for 6 months or a year, and you have the time to seek the subpoena through proper process. But this absolutely would address exigency, where we're trying to preserve life or prevent further damage to persons or their safety. Very briefly,
just 1 second.
No, I want to hear.
Oh, okay. Go ahead then.
Very briefly, subsection 5 of the same section on my page is page 5. Addressing the issue of a law enforcement agency obtaining information under the section, we do need to. I would urge that we need to have further insight into this section related to the suggestion that the evidence obtained should be presented to a circuit court within 72 hours. It's my understanding we don't currently have a process in place for that. And on the criminal side, we go through a grand jury. However, on the civil side, the exigency itself legally allows us to obtain that information without having to provide it after the fact. If there's no exigency involved, it's presumed that we would have already provided an affidavit to secure the subpoena or make a testimony under oath or a sworn statement to the court, to the DA's office, and the DA's office or city attorney or the circuit court actually is responsible for issuing this. Police officers have no power to issue a subpoena. We can merely request it based on the totality of the circumstances and the evidence that we have to present, which is why the legal standard of probable cause, tilting the scales, 51% certainty, more likely than not, comes into play and is extremely important. And it preserves the integrity of that idea without allowing law enforcement to overstep the bounds. The subsection 6 and 8, I believe, refer back and forth to one another. Personally, I would be opposed to language that included that anything gathered by law enforcement during the course of investigation should be released to the person being searched for if they're found alive. And this is new language to me, admittedly. That's not the policy of law enforcement generally, and most businesses wouldn't follow that policy. I think subsection 8, not having been there when it was drafted, I can't speak to that specifically, other than to say I think addressing confidential information remaining confidential, I'm not certain if that's exactly what that's for or not, but I just want to make sure that we do address the issues of confidentiality and the issues of investigative consistency. Law enforcement is not in the practice of destroying records. We wouldn't use them for any other purpose as written in the language here, but law enforcement does not destroy our records because we might have civil litigation to answer to. We might have, we don't want to recreate the wheel if the same person goes missing again, which happens a lot. Therefore, we would in fact want to maintain those documents to be used solely for community caretaking functions that are provided for under the Oregon Revised Statutes.
You said the same person goes missing again, and that happens a lot.
Coach Verger, maybe not in the essence or the idea of what the public sees on television, get the high profile cases, maybe not so much that. Senator Verger, it's very common when we're looking for persons who are mentally incapacitated, developmentally disabled, folks who have other issues that cause them to be unable to find their way home,
okay,
that we assign resources. That is very common, yes.
Follow up, Madam Chair. One other question. Today, if a person is reported to you at the Portland Police Department as missing, how many hours do you wait before you actually accept the fact that that person really is missing?
Coach Verger, our agency, and I'm proud of it, we have a policy of no waiting period. We will look at the totality of the circumstances in speaking with the reporting party or the complainant to determine if, in fact, that person meets the criteria based on LEDS, law enforcement data system, and the national standard, which Oregon mimics, for the criteria for accepting a missing persons report. But we do not have a waiting period for adults or children. In fact, federal law prohibits it for minors. So we take every report seriously. We take every report that meets the criteria, and I can personally vouch for the fact that every single missing persons report, adult and child, that gets submitted to the Portland Police Bureau is investigated fully, and we do not ever, since I took over the unit, ever suspend a case at any time. We will maintain a missing persons report in perpetuity for over 99 years.
Thank you, and Officer, first of all, I appreciate everything you do. I know you got a hard job, and I'm all for finding people in a timely fashion, especially with a life-saving, life-threatening situation. But when we talk about expanding more power of forcing people to provide information upon a request of a police officer without a subpoena in your hand first, I get real skittish about that conversation. Can you just paint me a picture here? Give me an example of when you would or why you would need to do this. Just an example, if you would.
Coach Sherman, Representative Schaffler, absolutely. And let me be clear. We're not asking for police officers to have more power, per se. What we're asking for is the statutory authority that would be under the auspices of the circuit court to grant that authority to gather the information. Police officers going to a business per se, let's use, just because of a recent high profile case, let's use the example of a hotel. To go to the hotel when you believe that at that moment exigency exists, meaning if you don't act immediately to gather the information that may be available, someone could die between the time you would approach the judge for a search warrant or another legal process, specific articulable facts document, to gather that same information. And let's presume for the moment there's no element of a crime involved because we already have the process in place for criminal investigation. We're talking about community caretaking, saving our citizens and visitors to our state. If we believe that a child's in danger, a medical condition, and I know I said I'm going to use the hotel example, it might be different than what you expected. Child's in danger. They were with their parents at a particular hotel. They have a medical emergency. Doctors have told police that if that child does not receive appropriate medication within X number of hours, and you're talking it's 2 o'clock in the morning when you're taking care of this business, that child could die, whether or not the parents even realize it. We go to that hotel and want to find out maybe a cell phone information that they provided to the hotel, or more importantly, since we're not really looking at information covered by federal telecommunications law, credit card that was used, so that we can go to a specific bank and target them in the middle of the night, because we have 24/7 contact with them, to say, here is the evidence of why we believe these people are using their card. We need you to look up in your records and find out what they've done since then. Which gas station did they go to? Where did they buy milk for the babies? Things like that that can't wait till the next business day, because that child may die between when you receive the information and when you act on it. And I can say specifically that we have saved numerous lives by relying on the goodwill of businesses to provide that information voluntarily. What EXNC does by establishing a civil investigative subpoena is simply say, we're asking you to recognize our authority if we had the time and someone's life was in immediate peril. We'll still get you that document if you require it after the fact, because we believe probable cause exists to get that. We're asking you, recognizing that authority, please voluntarily provide it ahead of time, knowing that we have the authority to force you to present it, but it would take a considerable amount of time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morrison.
Well, constitutionally, probable cause trumps right to privacy, right?
Co-Chairman, Senator Morrison. No, not always in private sector law. We seldom can force private sector businesses to provide.
Criminal law, it would, though.
Well, let's.
I mean, you can stop and search and seizure probable cause. In criminal law, you can do that.
Sure, but yes, and okay. Co-Chair Boone, Senator Morissette, criminal law is a separate issue,
yeah,
really,
because we
already have the legal process okay. in place.
So you're talking just civil probable cause, which is different.
Probable cause is the legal standard, but more likely than not is the way I'm referring to it. It's a legal standard. Doesn't always mean in criminal law. It just is the standard of tilting the scales 51% certainty,
yeah.
more likely than not. That being the case, say we have a person that we believe is suicidal and we're trying to save their life, and, or they're medically endangered and they don't realize the danger they're in because of their mental or medical incapacity, we may not be looking at a criminal element at all to use the laws that already exist. Therefore, we're looking for the creation of a civil authority when absent, specifically for instances where there is no criminal element. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Well, it just seems to me that probable cause, if someone's life is in danger and you have probable cause, you do what you have to do and apologize later or go to court later and justify. I mean, probable cause is a very, very strong concept in law. I mean, that is huge. And I think that if there is even a civil endangerment, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
And Co-Chair Boone, Senator Morissette, I would agree with you in concept, but the realistic fact is that police do not have the ability to force private sector businesses to give us anything,
okay.
which is what we're trying to seek change for.
Good.
So I appreciate the support for these issues.
Thank you.
Senator Bridger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. What are the chances of a person being found alive who has been missing for over 2 weeks?
Co-Chair Boone, Co-Chair Bridger. I have learned one thing, if nothing else, in all the years I've been doing this and all these cases. There are no rules. I have seen cases that were truly what people would describe as a miracle. It runs the gamut. There have been cases where people don't survive 5 minutes when you think they should survive a week. And there are cases where they've survived a month where you didn't think they would survive 2 days. So there really is no statistic, I think, available for that. I think it's always on a case-by-case basis. But having the tool available to us to address each of those cases on a case-by-case basis would be a huge boon to the safety of the state and its citizens and visitors.
Thank you. Some people may be considered missing, but they're not. They just don't want to be found. There's nothing wrong with them. They're not sick. But yeah, that's right. Let's just say, and I'm just trying to work this out in my own mind here. Forgive me here, because I'm leery about this. I'm not going to be beat around the bush here. Let's say you, as a police officer, want to talk to me. I'm a suspect, but you don't. There's no evidence proving I did anything. I'm innocent until proven guilty. I don't want to talk to you. I've chosen not to talk to you. I don't have to talk to you. So you call in a missing person on me. I'm not missing. I just don't want to be found. Now you have this ability to go and get all this information on me, even though I haven't really done. And let's say I'm innocent. You just suspect me of something. What I'm afraid of, officer, is the misuse of this. That's really what I'm concerned about. And I'm skittish about this whole thing. But I do appreciate your reasons, and I know you would prudently use this, always in good faith. I'm absolutely confident of that. But it's broader than just looking for sick people and times of emergency. It's just broader than that for me. Can you see that scenario coming about somehow, what I just spelled out?
Representative Schaffler. I understand your concerns, and I share the same concerns, and I would want to make certain that they are followed to the letter of the law, which is why there's actually language in here that expressly forbids use for anything other than a community caretaking function. Mm-hmm. We don't need another law to address criminal investigation. We already have criminal investigative laws. We already have the power of subpoena and the power of search warrants. And at no time is anyone, there's no reason to want to circumvent that system. It already exists. Mm-hmm. So to address your concern, I respect the concern itself, but I would offer that we already have everything in place we need for criminal law. And I'll admit, I wear two hats. I work in the homicide detail. I investigate homicides and death investigations, Measure 11 serious assaults. I also investigate missing persons cases. But in dealing with law enforcement all over this country, there's a clear delineation from community caretaking to criminal law. And I would just offer briefly that Oregon Revised Statutes allows for a police officer in a community caretaking function to boot someone's door in without a warrant to check for a lost or missing person or sick or injured. We already have that in the law. It's been challenged over and over, and it has not been abused. And we've had that for years.
And just for the record, you always know where to find me.
Are there questions for Mr. Weinstein? Thank you very much. I feel safer already, so when I get lost, I'm calling. I want you to find me.
I'll have my beacon on, Representative, so maybe we'll dial right in there.
Okay, and now our final witness would be Vicki McConnell for Senate Bill 1003. Welcome.
Well, thank you. For the record, I'm Vicki McConnell, the Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'll make this very quick. I came prepared to comment on Senate Bill 1003 as written. I did not know that there were amendments that profoundly change the direction of the bill. So at this point, I would not be prepared to comment on that, and we'll wait until I see the amendments. Thank you.
Okay, then we won't ask you any questions.
Don't ask me any questions. I would like to say to Representative Schaffler, there are some of us that actually climb mountains that have volcanic eruptions occurring at the same time. So, you know, there's just this compelling reason to want to climb those mountains.
I'll pray for you.
There. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2555, and I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1002, and I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1003. And I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2185, and call up, our administrator, I'll let you give the little intro.
Thank you, ma'am. House Bill 2185, we last heard this bill, on March 2nd, and authorized the Director of Human Services to appoint Public Health Director, defines duties of Public Health Director, establishes authority of Public Health Director, State Public Health Authority, and Local Public Health Authority to take certain actions during public health emergency, modifies authority of Governor to take certain actions during state of public health emergency. We were advised that there would be amendments to the bill. Those have been provided in your packets, and it is the dash one.
Thank you. And I'm going to call people up by threes. Dr. Susan Allen, Dr. Tom Eversole, and Dana Brenner? Brannett? Brainer. I'm sorry, Dana. And welcome. And so just identify yourselves for the record. You can choose who goes first, second, or third.
Okay. Co-Chair Boone, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Susan Allen, the State Public Health Director with the Department of Human Services, and I'll present the first testimony. Would it be appropriate to have my partners introduce themselves meanwhile?
Absolutely. That's fine.
For the record, Co-Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dana Brainer. I'm the Chief of Critical Care at the Dornbecker Children's Hospital and a professor of medicine.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Eversole. I'm Health Administrator for Benton County.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2185 with the amendments that have been provided to you. I've had the pleasure of addressing the committee on this bill previously. The amendments are mostly in the order of clarification, minor modifications, and housekeeping. So the basic provisions are similar to what you've heard and seen before, although some of the amendments are of great interest to others who will testify after me as well. But there, based on my previous testimony, I will be brief regarding what's in the bill. The current state laws for addressing public health and medical emergencies were said by a legal analysis to be very weak, fragmented, and they failed to provide many of the tools that would be essential in addressing major disease outbreaks or other health threats during an emergency. Without the provisions in this bill, the state and local public health authorities may not be able to protect the individuals and communities during emergencies. No bill is perfect, and this one does not answer all of the important questions, but we believe it addresses some critical gaps and weaknesses in the current state law. Some of the issues this bill addresses include: on quarantine and isolation, this clearly describes appropriate and detailed procedures that will both allow prompt and decisive action by a state or local public health official when needed, but also include detailed provisions and protections for the rights of individuals. Our current state law has neither of those, and our current state law also does not have any provisions for addressing potential quarantine or isolation of groups when needed. This bill would allow for the establishment of a consistent response across communities and facilities in events such as where systems would be overwhelmed, resources might be scarce, there's an unusual event that requires multi-community or multi-facility coordination. We do not currently have these laws. This will improve both the effectiveness of a response, but also the fairness of a response in a high-stress situation. Management of remains. Our current state law does not provide the authority for anyone to authorize urgent management of a large number of human remains. We think it would be good to have that provision. And regarding toxic contaminations or radiation, there are gaps in our current law with respect to our ability to assess toxic hazards and also to manage toxic hazards. This bill would address that. The bill does not address all of the issues that have been raised in the review of the state's public health emergency laws, and in particular that of liability. I share many of the concerns regarding the need to address liability protections for volunteers, for responders acting in emergencies or under guidelines issued by the state. This is an important and complex issue which is broader than just medical emergencies. We do not believe this bill is the vehicle for addressing that, and would encourage that there be an opportunity at some point to look at liability issues. We would actively participate in a proper assessment and development of appropriate proposals, which we think would be important for advancing the state's emergency preparedness. Although the bill does not directly address liability, some of the provisions will help with protecting the liability risks for healthcare providers, in that currently, without guidelines, authority to issue guidelines, individual facilities or providers would be pretty much on their own to figure out what to do in a high-stress or a scarce resource situation. With the authority to identify appropriate guidelines at a state level, so long as the providers then met those new guidelines, that actually provides them a kind of defense against a claim that they have that they were not providing appropriate care. So there actually is a significant improvement in liability protections for providers, although this doesn't take it the whole way with indemnification or more detailed. This bill was a result of considerable time and effort and serious thought by many individuals and organizations, and we very much appreciated the hard thought and the considerable time that people put in. A number of the participants have taken time off from work and are here today to testify with respect to this bill, and we appreciate their effort to voice their interests on our behalf. Andrea Meyer from the ACLU could not be here and authorized me to read the following statement on her behalf. Andrea Meyer from the ACLU asked me to convey to the committee her apologies that she could not attend this hearing. She's out of state, but otherwise would have appeared and testified in support of House Bill 2185. ACLU believes that House Bill 2185 goes a long way to providing critical due process protections to Oregonians and important clarity to current law. I believe that Ken Murphy, the director of Oregon Emergency Management, has also submitted written testimony in support of the bill. Again, we know that the bill does not answer all of the questions, but it does answer many important questions. Emergency preparedness is a complex process which requires many building blocks, and this bill, we believe, is the opportunity to put some more of the fundamental building blocks in place that would allow us to be able to protect the people and the communities in Oregon during a health or medical emergency. And thank you for your support for this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Allen. So, I'm going to go next.
Thank you again. Co-Chair Boone and Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, thank you for letting me address you this afternoon. As I mentioned, my name is Tom Eversole, and I'm the Health Administrator for Benton County. I also come speaking on behalf of the Conference of Local Health Officials, of which I'm a member of their Executive Committee, and the state's Public Health Emergency Preparedness Committee, on which I work. House Bill 2185 addresses some important concerns for state and local public health authorities. Public health officials need the ability to manage multi-community events and multi-jurisdictional events in a coordinated and consistent manner. Oregon law does not provide a clear, effective way for us to do that at this point. In fact, current law sometimes makes barriers to actually assuring the health security of Oregonians in an emergency. Local health departments have been active partners in preparing the proposed revision of public health laws for managing emergencies. Public health officials on all levels have worked together for several years to coordinate the emergency operations reflected in this bill. The proposed updates improve our ability to protect people in local communities as well as across the state. House Bill 2185 clarifies state and local roles. It provides a clearer and stronger public health tools that we need in order to manage emergency situations. This bill also improves the quarantine and isolation laws. It outlines more comprehensive and modern procedures that recognize the rights of individuals. The bill adds provisions for quarantine and isolation of groups for those rare instances in which such responses might be needed. Most importantly, House Bill 2185 improves the ability of state and local officials to protect individuals in our communities. Public health law revisions are necessary for me to do my job effectively, and I urge you to enact and accept these changes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dr.
Brainer.
Sorry.
Thank you, Coach.
I just had surgery at your hospital. I think there's still a few brain cells still lacking.
Let's see if we can find those.
Okay. Oh. Send them back.
What a jar.
They got that police officer out searching for him right now.
Might need more authority.
Okay.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, just to reintroduce myself, my name is Dana Brainer. I'm one of 10 critical care physicians for children in the state of Oregon, covering only 32 beds for critically ill children in this state. In addition, I'm also a habitual disaster responder, responding to disasters throughout the world and here in the United States. And I also served for the CDC as a consultant on children's disaster issues. I cannot stress the importance of having an organized plan to deal with disaster issues strongly enough to prevent undue illness and undue hardship for our children. We need a coordinated plan in place to take care of critically ill people in the event of a disaster that's consistent throughout all of the hospitals in the region. It is important that limited resources go to the people who need them most, and this bill goes a very long way to doing this, and for that reason it gets my complete support.
Thank you. Questions to this panel? Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down today. The next panel will be Kara Fisher, Stephen Jones, and Heather. Dr. Heather Hugh. Even with the glasses, I couldn't get it. Welcome. Rose.
Would you like me to
start? Carol, you start and introduce yourself.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kara Fisher with the Association of Oregon Counties. In its original form, House Bill 2185 did not meet all of the needs that counties in Oregon had on how this bill would respond to public health emergencies. A number of legal counsel and public health professionals from actually a fair number of our counties participated actively with Department of Human Services, the Sheriff's Association, and others to create the Dash 1 amendments. With the Dash 1 amendments, we are very happy with the bill, and I will very shortly tell you that we respectfully request your adoption of the Dash 1 amendments and to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to take questions.
Any questions for Kara?
Madam Chair, I noticed that there's a possible fiscal and revenue. What are we talking about in terms of the fiscal and revenue impact?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Morissette, that might be actually a better question directed at
you're right.
At someone else.
I wanted to raise that question at some point, and I don't know, you know, you're right. Not the one to answer that. But,
well, if I may say that our original concern with the bill was increased exposure to potential risk and liability. And with the Dash 1 amendments, we feel that a number of those concerns have been alleviated, at least at the county level. But I can't speak to the state level.
Madam Chair, do we have someone, I guess it would be the Public Health Department that would ultimately answer that question.
Probably, yeah.
No, okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
I'll wait.
Okay. Yes. Good. Dr. Jones, is it Dr. Jones?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, as a member of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of this bill. I'm a physician specializing in internal medicine and infectious diseases. I'm a member of the medical advisory group that's been working on preparedness for public health disasters in the state of Oregon. 40 years ago, I was in the military as a preventive medicine officer for 2 years. And as a member of the medical advisory group, I have become surprised in how little authority rests in our public health authorities here in the state for dealing with epidemics. Epidemics are, while not common, are important and dangerous. I had more authority as a 27-year-old than perhaps our state public health director has now. I think this legislation, if passed, will bring the authority that I believe is common sense and necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hugh, welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Heather Hugh. I am board-certified internal medicine physician. I also practice hospitalist medicine. That's provision of care to the acute hospitalized patient. I also wear two other hats. I'm an active committee member on the OMA Legislative Committee, as well as also serve on the medical advisory group to the State Public Health Division. I've come here today primarily as a physician of the community in support of the House Bill 2185. To elaborate on the rationale behind my support, I feel that upon the occurrence of a public health emergency, as a physician, it is imperative that we know and are familiar with who is in charge, the scope of his or her authority and responsibility, and how we as a medical community can swiftly and appropriately respond in a coordinated, consistent, and fair fashion to a public health emergency. I feel that this bill begins to address the fundamental needs of the medical community. It outlines an authority, and I want to state that Dr. Allen has been very visible and transparent in this process of creating this bill and outreaching to the medical community. And I also feel that it provides material and a platform on which a substantial public health care response can be further built, directed, and successfully executed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? We think we're very lucky to have Dr. Allen, too. Thank you very much. And I will now call the next panel, Bob Shoemaker, Kevin Campbell, and Andy Easton. Welcome. Senator Shoemaker.
Oh, Representative Boone.
We miss you here, but I know you're doing a lot
too.
Of fun things.
How shall we proceed?
Any way you like. Just introduce yourself and go away.
Thank you. Chairs Berger and Boone, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here on behalf of law enforcement to also extend our appreciation to Dr. Allen and her team. This bill was the product of a lot of conversation, and the language of the bill that's before you this morning or this afternoon is a work product that represents our agreement. I also want to indicate that, you know, as emergency responders, law enforcement obviously deals with a wide range of experiences, and we have to be prepared for a wide range of inevitabilities. Public health challenges are unique, and they require more than most a clear clarification of roles and responsibilities. I think that's what occurs and is made possible through language of the bill. In addition, some of the areas of statute that aren't always clearly defined related to quarantine and other of those sensitive areas, I think, are addressed carefully in this. It gives us the ability to work together. So when this kind of emergency does occur, we believe that our folks understand our role, who will be making decisions, how we will cooperate on the ground, so that the beneficiaries of this are the citizens that will be suffering because of whatever public health emergency occurs. And so I wanted to be very brief and just put on the record that the law enforcement community has been a part of this process and that we appreciate the work of Dr. Allen and her team, and we support the bill.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Boone and Senator Berger, members of the committee. My name is Bob Shoemaker. I am formerly a member of the legislature, as some of you know, lawyer now and pretty much retired, a member of the Public Health Advisory Board, and in that capacity I was asked to chair the working group that dealt with the process of pulling this bill together and listen to the various interest groups who were interested in different aspects of the bill. I'm here really just to advise you of that very participatory process that we went through for some months with representatives, mostly people I've known in the past from my time in Salem, representing the associations of doctors, hospitals, nurses, Oregon counties, local health care officials, the ACLU, and others. It was a large group, and we worked very effectively together. Their interests were all placed on the table, thoroughly discussed, and the product of that is what you have before you. And I think and they think that it's a very good product, and I'm looking forward to its passage. Thanks.
Thank you. Andy?
Co-Chairs Boone and Berger, I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Hospital Association. I believe in front of you, you have a copy of Gwen Dayton, Vice President and Legal Counsel of the Association's testimony. We applaud the leadership of Dr. Allen to work with various stakeholders to improve this bill. Through the process, a number of our concerns have been addressed through the Dash 1 amendments. Unfortunately, two key components for garnering hospital support on this bill have not been completely addressed. Those two key components include liability protection and the governor's authority to take over hospitals in the case of an emergency. Healthcare providers play a critical role in caring for patients in the event of a public emergency. This bill gives the governor and the public health director the ability to significantly restrict the discretion and professional scope of practice for hospitals and other providers, yet does not provide them coverage for liability. Hospitals fully agree that the role we play is significant in caring for the ill or wounded in a case of a mass emergency. And we agree that our role, along with the state, must work together in coordinating those cares. None of us anticipate the governor actually taking over a hospital's operation in such a case. However, the governor believes it needs to be in law. We do not believe that this course of action should serve the patients well. Thank you.
Questions? Anybody? Helen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question is around the testimony from Dr. Allen, who acknowledged that we haven't addressed the liability issues in this particular bill, that this is perhaps not the appropriate vehicle, but that is something that we do need to address. I guess I'm wondering if the Hospital Association does kind of see the need for the issues that are addressed in the bill, and if you feel that those are issues that we do need to address at this particular point in time.
Co-chairs Boone and Berger and Representative Cowan. I know that Gwen Dayton has been working very diligently with Dr. Allen on this issue. We would like to see some coverage in the bill going forward, and we would be more than happy to work with her and her staff in the future on developing a bill that would satisfy our needs.
Okay, thank you very much. You're just for that, aren't you?
And I understand the position of the hospital in terms of not having the governor take over. If there is a regional disaster, for instance, on the coast, and there is a necessity to move things around, for instance, maybe even out of the building to another location or to use some of the resources somewhere and so on, I guess I feel that the hospital's obligation, well, I don't want to say the obligation is to their own facility, and many times the hospital would say, hey, we're happy to do that on our own. But I guess I could see instances where someone would have to step in and do some things that may not be the most popular things to do. So, but you don't like that part of the bill, is that right? Okay. I respect that and I understand that, but I just think that there might be some areas and circumstances where that would be the desirable things to do for public safety. So,
could I insert a comment on that point, even though
Please.
It was not my testimony? This question came up when we were meeting with the Oregon Hospital Association, including its president, and he was concerned about the provision of sort of taking over the hospital. And I pointed out to him a provision in the bill that requires the governor and the governor's delegate, the public health director normally, to consult with the hospital, seriously consult with the hospital before making those arrangements. And when I pointed that out to him, he said he was satisfied with that.
Good.
Co-chairs and Senator Morissette, thank you very much for that input. We would be very satisfied with that if the governor were to consult with our CEOs or the hospital administrator.
I do believe the bill so provides.
Rep. Shoffler.
Thank you. Yeah, if we ever did have to, if there was a need to evacuate a hospital because of structural damage and they had to build a new one, and they went and got tax-free bonds and low-interest loans from the state to pay for that construction, I would hope all those workers got paid prevailing wage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh,
no,
okay.
I would have been disappointed if you hadn't brought up that issue.
Don't we have to cut some trees?
Because they're already being paid union wages building them anyway.
Cut some trees today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all.
And our final candidate for testimony is Claudia Black.
There's a punt of Mercedes when they come through.
They're Ford pickups.
We didn't mention the trees we have to cut to get over.
Thanks for reminding me.
Well, I'm going to pay attention to
this. How we can join. Increase understanding.
Welcome, Claudia.
Thank you. Co-chairs Boone Berger and Berger and committee members. My name is Claudia Black, and I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association today. The OMA supports House Bill 2185 with the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that it's important for the state to have centralized authority and a plan in place in the event of a large-scale public health emergency. House Bill 2185 with the Dash 1 amendments would give the state the authority to coordinate health care providers' activities during a public health emergency. We worked closely with the Department of Human Services and other entities in the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, and believe that they address most of the concerns that we've raised.
And while we support the bill, as you've heard from Dr. Allen, we're still concerned that it exposes physicians to significant liability when they are responding at the state's request to a public health emergency. So physicians are left open to liability for any decisions or actions that they take, even when acting at the public health director's authority and direction and following treatment options or guidelines dictated by the public health director. If the outcome's less than desirable, the physicians can be sued and held solely responsible for their actions. We believe that if a physician is responding at the direction of the public health director, the physician should be afforded the same liability protection as the public health director and should be indemnified by the state.
Why didn't they do that?
Such an action, we think, is necessary to avoid the individual physician from being held responsible for actions taken at the direction of the public health director. And one other issue we'd like to raise concerns the fine, the civil penalty assessed for the violation of the public health law. And as the bill is written, it allows Department of Human Services to assess $500 per occurrence, per violation. The exact amount and specific violations are going to be determined later by rule. And although we understand DHS's desire to have a significant penalty in place to prevent and deter violations, we think that $500 a day would be sufficient to deter those violations. And we look forward to working with Dr. Allen on addressing the liability issues. As I said, we support the concept of the bill. We think it's something that really needs to be in place, but we are very concerned about the liability issues. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we all are. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give me some insight on why it has been so far in the negotiations that we haven't seen movement on the liability issue? Maybe Dr. Allen would be better to answer that question.
I have a couple of questions.
Co-chairs and Senator George, yeah. Dr. Allen probably would be better able to address that issue.
And while you're at it, could you address the fiscal issue, too, for Senator Morissette?
Madam, is it Madam Co-Chairs? I'm sorry, that's the proper way when there are two. Co-Chair Boone and members of the committee, with respect to the liability issue, the explanation is actually fairly similar to what you heard from Joe O'Leary in the prior set of bills, which is that there was a deliberate intention to pull out those things which were not fiscal impact authorities and responsibilities and rules, and to recognize that the fiscal impact has all sorts of other complications and review routes, which we were not in a position to take on at this point. The other point, my own concern, and again, I will voice again, I believe this would be very appropriate for the state to take a serious look at this. Many states have come up with bills that have supported more active engagement in emergency planning once they address this. At the same time, it's more than just medical care providers. Emergencies affect many other parts of the community. Many other people become volunteer responders who in an emergency may be doing medical types of support but are not medical providers in the usual sense. So I would urge that we look at liability and that we do so recognizing that it's complex and much broader than just what this limited scope. This is actually a fairly limited scope bill. And so that's the other part of the answer.
Okay. I think she would, do you have a, go ahead, Representative Shuffler.
I'm just going to repeat the question that was asked about the potential cost of this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill has no direct fiscal cost. I mean, in an emergency, of course, costs happen anyway, but this bill generates no additional cost beyond what just the current state of life and law would create.
Wow. That's good.
Senator Berger.
Dr. Allen, this is going to be a very cynical remark, but I just am beginning to wonder if anybody does anything anymore for the good of the order.
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, I believe many people do, including yourselves and many of my staff, and I know the good people who came to testify on behalf of this bill came out of commitment to the good of the order as well. You knew that, and I appreciate your giving an opportunity for me to say that.
And we appreciate it very much. Senator
Morrison? Well, I guess there are no startup costs. There's no planning costs. You're absorbing whatever costs there is, or is there emergency management money going into it, homeland security money going into it? What you've said is that there is no cost until an emergency happens, but then don't we have to get ready for it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morissette, that is a very important point, and that's a much bigger topic that and I would be glad to discourse a little more on. There are many costs related to emergency planning and preparedness that we're struggling with. The only funding that we have in Oregon is federal funding. There's no state money in our emergency preparedness. At the same time, this bill is really about coordinating response to things that are happening or would happen anyway, rather than creating new plans. So we are planning with hospitals. The hospitals and the medical associations have been very engaged in the planning. This will help us plan better. It won't change the planning, the amount of planning. It'll just be better planning.
In other words, this bill will go directly to the floor of the House Senate. It will not go to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that is my dear hope.
Okay, the reality check will be...
No, there is no subsequent referral unless some grand surprise happens. Senator George L.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we have Dr. Allen up here, could you address a little bit about what the hospitals were discussing about the clause in it that allows the governor to take control of hospitals and why there isn't some ability to accommodate their concerns in that?
Madam Chair and Senator George, there actually was in the earlier draft pre-amendment a provision in there that simply copied existing state law from another section related to that. We actually, at the request of the Hospital Association, deleted that specific hospital reference regarding the governor's authorities. So there's nothing in this bill, so far as I'm aware, it's complicated, it's gone through drafts, but I believe we have nothing that explicitly authorizes that. Any authorities that the governor would have to take over a hospital are under a whole different section, which is the governor's general emergency powers, where the governor can do a lot of things in an emergency, but we have created nothing in here that targets or specifically addresses hospitals. With respect to some of the activities that do work with hospitals in this bill, we have added provisions regarding consultation and coordination around activities such as if a quarantine or isolation were to be directed in a hospital, the provisions about issuing guidelines, clinical or treatment guidelines, that would be with consultation with appropriate experts. So we've added some things in to ensure that there would be coordination and consultation, but it's under the general emergency powers, which have nothing to do with this bill, that there still is potentially the opportunity for the governor to take control of whatever might seem to be necessary in an emergency. I don't think we can erase that power in this bill.
Okay. Representative Callan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel compelled to address the for the good of the order question. I understand the challenges of liability, but in my years' experience with emergency providers, I've never seen anyone stop and try to evaluate their liability in times of crisis when a need arises, nor for that part their own safety in many cases as well. What I would appreciate, Dr. Allen, commenting on briefly is the years of planning and discussion that's gone into this bill, the product that we have here before us, because I know this dated back to some examinations of our state law and many, many hours, speaking of a lot of volunteer time that's gone into the efforts on the part of the many people who testified here today and others who have worked on pulling this together. And I think it might be helpful to the committee to sort of look at just how long this bill has been in coming.
Madam Chair and Representative Cowan. My own involvement with this is since my 2 years here in the state. And when I first came to Oregon, one of the things I wanted to know was, what was I responsible to do? What did I have the authority to do? And it turned out it was actually distressingly little on both accounts. What I found is that in the early, I think it was 2001, 2002, there had been convened an extensive review of the state's public health laws as part of a national project called the Turning Point Project. And an analysis of the laws and a series of recommendations were developed at that time, which provided a really sound basis for us to move ahead on when we convened the group that was referenced by Bob Shoemaker a little over a year ago, to take that work and to translate it into something that actually happened. So you could say in some ways this has been 5 or 6 years in the making.
Okay, last question.
Last question. Well, I was somewhat involved in trying to figure out what public health was all about for two sessions, and the bill died. We had an enumeration of powers that we thought was great that would kind of say what you guys are supposed to do. My question, though, is you mentioned that other states have done some liability work, and are we looking at what they are doing as a model?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm collecting examples as they cross my desk, but we currently have no system or context within which to do that. I'm not authorized to create liability protections for the state, and we don't currently have a forum or venue for doing that review. The materials are out there, and they're easy to get, and I hope that as we proceed ahead with emergency planning that there will be something that pulls the right people together and gives them the authority to make something happen.
The state legislation or the state legislator councils, NCSL, for instance, have all kinds of information. CDC, don't they have information?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, CDC does not, but there's an association of state and territorial health officials, which is the national group for people like me, for example. So, and then, as you've mentioned, there are the associations of state legislators. So I think getting the information won't be the hard part. It will be getting the agreement and the momentum that will be the hard part. So,
okay, I'm going to.
Madam Chair, I don't have any more questions.
Oh, good. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2185 and open a work session. And I would like to entertain a motion to adopt
Madam
the Dash
Chair,
one.
I will move that the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2185.
Thank you. Senator Berger has moved the Dash 1 amendments be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objections? They are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2185, as amended, be moved to the House, to the Senate and House floors with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Berger has moved that we move to the floor House Bill 2185 as amended. Is there any discussion? Any objections? I'll have Gary call the roll, please.
Senator George L.
Aye.
Senator Johnson, Representative Greener.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Shockley.
Aye.
Senator George G.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, excused. Senator Berger.
Aye.
Chair Boone.
Aye. The motion carries.
Excuse me.
Hello.
Excuse me.
That's the second time you've been forgotten this year.
They did it to me.
No, I did it to her, so yeah. she deserved it.
I really didn't mean to do that. It's that turning this way doesn't work today.
Aye.
Okay. Now, motion carried. And
I need carriers
from the House.
I would be delighted to carry the bill.
Would you like to? Okay. Representative Cowan will carry the House. And the Senate?
On behalf of the
Senator Berger will carry in the Senate. Is there any more business before this committee? To stand adjourned.